Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. And after President Biden's speech in Georgia on Tuesday afternoon, I have only one question. I think I'll let AC/DC ask it.
Are you ready?
Entirely quiet.
Are you ready?
I know I wasn't quite prepared for President Joe Biden 20.22, who let us know that he is all the way woke and ready.
I've been having these quiet conversations with the members of Congress for the last 2 months. I'm tired of being quiet.
Sir, speak your truth. During a speech given in Atlanta, Georgia, the state which truly held the Senate and presidency in the balance during the last election, President Biden sounded fiery about it and put the filibuster square in his sights.
Sadly, the United States Senate, designed to be the world's greatest deliberative body, has been rendered a shell of its former self. Gives me no satisfaction in saying that, as an institutionalist, as a man who was honored to serve in the Senate. But as an institutionalist, I believe that the threat to our democracy is so grave that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills. Debate them, vote, let the majority prevail. And if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster for this.
And for the president, this is not just a battle about this moment. It's a question of history and of the nation's future.
History has never been kind to those who've sided with voter suppression over voters' rights. And it'll be even less kind for those who side with election subversion. So I ask every elected official in America, how do you want to be remembered? Consequential moments in history, they present a choice. Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? This is the moment to decide, to defend our elections, to defend our democracy. I'm tired of being quiet.
Joining me now is our voting rights bestie, Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. Ari, as always, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Melissa. Great to be back. Thank you.
And also here is Barbara Arnwine, president and founder of the Transformative Justice Coalition. Barbara, I can't even say your name without smiling. It's so good to have you.
It's wonderful to be on. Thank you, Melissa. And I can't always give you credit for starting this week in voter suppression back in 2011 when nobody wanted to talk about this. Thank you for your leadership.
Oh, listen, I was going to say, like, having you and Ari here to continue to talk about voter suppression, voter subversion a decade later. I mean, on the one hand, it always makes me happy to have the two of you at my table. On the other hand, it's been a decade. So Barbara, before we get to the kind of nuts and bolts policy here, I just want to start with the rhetoric, with the language, because I do feel like over the 4 years of the Trump administration, we really talked a lot in our public conversations about how important presidential rhetoric and the bully pulpit is when we would hear particular kinds of language from the president, even if there wasn't policy attached to it. We stopped, we paused, and we said that mattered. And I was a bit surprised to see that folks were kind of poo-pooing what the president said yesterday and saying that it didn't matter. So let me ask you, did what the president say yesterday matter?
It matters if the speech is a prelude to action. The speech is just a first step. What he needs to do next is to go to the Senate and give the same speech, but in a different way. He needs to walk those halls of the Senate and pump some hands and do some talks. He needs to bring people to that White House. We need to see that today, tomorrow, this weekend, Monday. We need to see real action. Nobody told him not to speak. But he says, I'm tired of being quiet. I'm like, we've been to jail. I've been arrested 3 times. We've been out in front of the White House saying, speak up on the filibuster. We've been arrested at the Hart Building saying, speak up at the on the filibuster. We've been arrested in Phoenix, Arizona, trying to get cinema to do the right thing. He needs to take a different approach here, a much more aggressive approach to make sure that this bill is passed. The speech is one thing, action is another.
Okay, so Ari, let me come to you on what that strategy might look a bit like, because I wondered if there was a moment, you know, as the president was speaking, rather than talking about Sinema and Manchin, which has been the obsession, right, kind of get the every member of the party together, he actually called out the 16 senators who previously had supported the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. Can you talk about whether or not, first of all, who some of those 16 are, and whether or not any of them are movable in this new political moment?
Well, I can tell you that one of them is Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell led the effort to get Republicans to support the Voting Rights Act's reauthorization in 2006. He said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, meaning that reauthorize it for another 25 years. And then, of course, after the Congress voted 390-33 in the House and 98-0 in the Senate to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, the Supreme Court gutted it 7 years later. And then virtually no Republicans have supported reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act since. Lisa Murkowski was the only Republican to sign on to the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. But I think the larger purpose of the Biden speech was Democrats have been pursuing a two-track strategy with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. They've applied a lot of internal pressure. There's been a lot of internal discussions with them about the filibuster. But what's been missing is the outside pressure from the White House. Barbara and lots of other activists have been applying the outside pressure from the grassroots level. But people have really wanted Biden to make the case of why this needs to be done now and why Democrats have to do it alone if it comes to that. And I think they've been waiting and waiting and waiting for the White House to make that case. Biden gave a major speech about voting rights in July, but didn't mention the filibuster. And then months and months and months passed, and the White House basically said nothing about the threats to our democracy. And so there is a real question of whether this is too little, too late. But I think the words by the president matter. And speaking to this issue so directly, I think is important, not just for swaying Manchin Sinema, but for trying to rouse the public about why this is an urgent issue as well. Because I think a lot of people paid attention to January 6th and the insurrection. But what they haven't paid as much attention to is everything that's happened since the insurrection, which has essentially been an insurrection through other means.
Okay. So all right, I want to walk through a couple of these. So Barbara, let me come back to you on this point that both you and Ari were making here about this outside pressure that has been applied, the work of activists, of local folks, of communities, of national organizations, the kind of shouting it from the rooftops work, and as you've been pointing it out, literally in the jail cells. And yet, you know, we had several Georgia groups announce that they were not on Monday. They announced they weren't going to attend the president's speech yesterday. They skipped the speech. And, you know, just kind of like watching some of it happen around media and social media, help me to understand that landscape of sort of where voting rights activists and organizations are on a moment like what happened yesterday.
Well, I think they are disgusted because think about it. This week, all the groups have been going to Lincoln County. There's a petition drive there because Lincoln County, Georgia, is trying to eliminate 6 of their 7 polling sites, 28% African-American area. That means that there would be only one in the downtown district, which would take a lot of people to drive. There's no Lyft, there's no Uber folks, there's no buses. It would be an insane, insanely disenfranchising measure. And they've been working on that all week. And they're like, no, we don't need you in Georgia telling us what to do, especially when while you're here, the Georgia state legislature is voting to reduce drop boxes, taking 100 from, going from 100 plus in Fulton County to only 23 by their measure. All these disenfranchising measures, what you say in the speech won't change any of that. What will change it if you had given this speech in the Senate? They are saying, great speech, wrong location, wrong place. Be there, the only people who can make the change, who can pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, the only people who can pass the Freedom to Vote Act is the Senate, the senators. And that's who you need to be focusing your attention on. It's good to rile up the base. It's good to make people aware of what's happening in these states, but it's urgent to get the Senate to take action. And that's what people were saying. And I don't blame them. I understand their frustration. And I really support their saying, let's get this done. Let's stop the theatrics. It is absolutely imperative that you use not just your pulpit, but you use your presidential bully power, your presidential power to persuade and to influence and to create and generate the right votes. That's what we need right now. That's going to be the telling point of all of this work.
So Ari, remind us, what are the bills, what are the acts that are sitting there with the possibility of passing if they could pass with the simple majority?
The two bills are the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. The Freedom to Vote Act would set national standards for elections so that every state would have things like online election day and automatic voter registration, 2 weeks of early voting, expanded mail-in voting. It would ban partisan gerrymandering. It would take aim at new election subversion laws. And it really would be the most significant piece of democracy reform legislation since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And then, of course, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would restore the key provisions of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court gutted. So it would require states with a long history of discrimination, like Georgia, like Texas, to once again have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. So these bills together would both stop voting discrimination where it's historically occurred the most and also expand voting rights across the country. And there was a really interesting moment during Biden's speech as Biden was talking about the need for this voting rights legislation. At the same time, a court in North Carolina, your home state, released an opinion upholding gerrymandered legislative and congressional maps, including a U.S. House map that would give Republicans anywhere from 71 to 78% of seats in a state that Trump only won with 49.9% of the vote. And that really underscored the urgency of this moment. As Biden is talking about banning partisan gerrymandering, a court is upholding partisan gerrymandering. And that sort of tells it all right there.
Yeah, Barbara, let's pause on that for a second, because I do think and dig in there for a moment. I think gerrymandering is sometimes that piece where we miss, right? So we start talking about voter suppression. People get that, right? Being able to cast my ballot. But the idea, and particularly in a week when we lost Lonnie Guinier, can you help us remember why the gerrymander matters?
It matters because in states like Pennsylvania, states like Wisconsin, and many others, you have Democrats being the majority. I'm just using this as an example. Yet the Republicans dominate because they draw the districts in ways that Democratic voters cannot ever elect a candidate of their choice. And that makes it frustrating for those voters. You know, I've walked the streets with Wisconsin voters, talking with them and had hearings where they talked about how discouraging it is to know that if you're going to go to vote, that your vote's really not going to count to elect someone who you want and need elected to represent your district. It's very frustrating. And I think that, Ohio, Texas, all of these states, think about Texas. Texas got four, got all these, got two additional congressional seats because of the increase of 4 million of people in their state. And all of those were Latinos, basically, and a few African-Americans, and of course, a few whites, but it was predominantly Latino. And they drew all these new districts, but not one is structured where Latinos can win. That's the kind of gerrymandering we're talking about. That is just wrong, it's vicious, and it really discourages people from participating in the electoral process.
So, you know, Ari, I was listening to the president and listening to the ways he's speaking to different publics in that moment. Clearly, at least one part of what he was trying to do was a kind of moral suasion, right? An argument about history and what side you will be on. And I found it fascinating, right? He makes this point that even Strom Thurmond, right, voted to extend Voting Rights Act back in 1980. And I'm wondering, so if you're Senator Tim Scott, If you are a Republican, but a Republican who at least at one point, right, was sort of fighting for the soul of the Republican Party and saying we can win based on having better ideas, we don't have to win by rigging the game. Is there a possibility to move those senators simply by the power of moral suasion?
I don't think so. I think we're past the point where we can really rely on Republicans to support voting rights. And I actually think that language of moral persuasion, do you want to be on the side of Bull Connor or John Lewis, was really aimed at Sinema and Manchin, because that's the argument that Democrats are making to them. Do you want to be the two people that kill the last best chance at protecting voting rights for a century? And does it make sense for you to support the rights of the minority in the Senate, but not the rights of minority voters? And so I think Biden's moral suasion, yes, of course, he would love Republicans to work on them, but I think they hope this moral argument works on Manchin and Sinema, because clearly the in-the-weeds procedural stuff is not working with Manchin and Sinema. So the only way to get them off supporting the filibuster is to say, this is our last best chance to save American democracy. And if we don't do it, you are the ones that are going to be blamed for it happening.
And Ari, I need to hear you say that one more time. Why would you support the rights of the minority in the Senate, but not of minority voters? Say that for me one more time. I want to remember that.
That's the question that the Democrats are asking right now. How can you support the rights of the minority in the Senate, but not the rights of minority voters? That's it. That's the whole ball game. We're talking about supporting the right of Republican senators to filibuster democracy legislation, but we're not talking about protecting the fundamental rights of people all across this country. So I think Manchin Sinema really have it backwards in terms of who they want to protect.
Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, covering voting rights, and Barbara Arnwine, president and founder of the Transformative Justice Coalition. Thank you both for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
Schools across the country are in crisis. There's a shortage of teachers.
Arizona schools deal with teacher shortages during normal years, but now with Omicron surging, they're dealing with even fewer teachers available for the classroom.
Now, this is a problem that's been around, as long as we can remember. The shortage of substitute teachers, yet another issue made worse by the pandemic.
In some regions, the shortage of school personnel has led some school districts to cancel classes. It's also meant that substitute teachers who help to fill these gaps are more necessary than ever. For more on this, I spoke with Julia Hayward, reporter at the New York Times.
One thing that's really important to understand is that there have been several working conditions that teachers and other people at schools have faced for decades now. We're talking They're not paid very much. The hours are not anything that anyone wants to work. And now you've got this pandemic. People are concerned about their safety, particularly when they're working in a classroom, particularly when they're working with students. Not every parent wants to get their child vaccinated. And so what you're seeing now is a lot of teachers who are either retiring early, they're quitting altogether. We're seeing less and less people at teaching institutions now enrolled in teaching schools. The problem was always there, but the pandemic has made things worse.
Okay, so given that there are these staffing shortages, are there actually also substitute shortages? In other words, are there, for all of these same reasons, are there fewer substitute teachers?
It's not even just teachers or substitute teachers. It is literally everyone that you see at a school. The cafeteria worker, the principal, the secretary who works for the principal. We are seeing shortages with every single laborer who works within a school, including substitutes.
Got it. Now, are there states or regions where this is more of a problem?
We are seeing in particular states, I'm specifically thinking of Missouri and Oregon, that have completely gotten rid of their degree requirements. So these are states where you may not need a bachelor's or an associate's anymore to become a substitute teacher. We're seeing that in other districts. I'm thinking most recently Chicago, which made headlines for this past week. That is one place where we are seeing teachers' union telling the school district that they don't want to work in person anymore there. So we are seeing it in some areas more than others, but it's pretty much the whole nation that has been affected by this.
Okay, so given that we're looking at this national staffing shortage, you're tying it both to sort of these realities happening in the pandemic, but also these pre-pandemic realities of living and working in the school system. What has this meant for school districts? I mean, obviously you name check the Chicago example, where what it's meant is days without school, right? For families, for students, for teachers who were locked out, for city leaders. But what has it meant beyond these kind of big high profile moments like Chicago?
It's really affecting everybody who makes up the community at a school. Yesterday, I spoke with a high school freshman in Detroit who is missing out on a lot of those experiences you get in high school because he's had to do so much of it remotely. I mean, this is a place where our kids spend the majority of their day to day. And so if we're in a position now where schools are hanging by a thread, as some experts have told me, because of the lack of labor, because of the lack of available bodies they have in the classroom, the people who stand to suffer the most are our kids, the students.
Tell me, for substitutes, whether they've been substitute teachers, substitute gym and art teachers, whether they've been filling in for, as you said, the secretary in the principal's office, how have they been filling this void?
What you're seeing right now is the principal might become the bus driver, or teachers are now teaching classes that they have no expertise in. We have already seen through studies that the pandemic has resulted in learning loss for a lot of students. We are seeing test scores behind what they once were. So it's that quality of education isn't as good as it was beforehand. And frankly, it is students from more marginalized communities that are going to have to bear the brunt of this disparity we're seeing right now.
Obviously, there are districts where teachers are unionized, where perhaps they have some collective bargaining capacity. But even in places where they aren't, right, there's typically rules that help to protect teachers, at least in some ways, as professionals. Do substitute teachers have similar protections, or have they been thought of as more disposable and more easily replaceable?
You will definitely see this attitude at a lot of schools where substitutes sort of play second banana. They are the people you bring in when the teacher, the person who does the lesson planning, who for a lot of people does the real work, isn't available that day. Frankly, substitutes deal with far less pay than what teachers make, which keep in mind is still not that great. most teachers are grossly underpaid, and substitutes, because they are so infrequent within a classroom, I mean, you will send a substitute to teach a class that they may not get to teach again ever, or a substitute will come in 1 to 2 times a month, for example. At least that's what it was previously before this massive labor shortage. Substitutes kind of flew under the radar, and they weren't taken as seriously or really as valued as traditional teachers are.
You know, one of the things we've seen in places where labor was profoundly undervalued, let's take, for example, you know, low-wage work in fast food restaurants. Part of what's happened with the labor shortage has been now they're commanding higher wages simply because of the supply-demand question. Have we seen that for substitute teachers? Do they have more leverage, and are they able to ask for better pay and circumstances?
Yes, absolutely. We are seeing school districts try to further incentivize more people to become substitutes. We're seeing states that have lowered the requirements, and we're also seeing other districts that are raising the daily pay, that are including bonuses, for example. So on one hand, substitutes definitely can expect to get paid more. And I've spoken to several substitutes across the nation who say that they could work every single day filling in for a classroom if they wanted to. But at the same time, even though the demand has increased, there are a lot of structural issues with substitutes that still hasn't been addressed yet by schools.
Are there solutions kind of on the table? Is there a solution stream out there on the table? Particularly thinking about the fact that with the Omicron variant, we are reminded that in fact, we are not at the end.
The big thing I've seen is discussion around federal assistance. You will see this from unions that represent all education workers, including substitutes, that some sort of federal assistance could help bridge the gap with the level of resources that teachers have and the pay that they receive.
Julia Hayward is a reporter at the New York Times. Julia, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. During a January 5th hearing, Indiana Republican State Senator Scott Baldwin made these comments.
I'm not discrediting as a person Marxism, Nazism, fascism. I'm not discrediting any of those isms out there. And I have no problem with the education system providing instruction on the existence of those isms. I believe that we've gone too far when we take a position on those isms as it relates to, we need to be impartial. Again, I'm gonna use this term. We need to be the purveyors of reason. We just provide the facts. The kids formulate their own viewpoints.
After being roundly criticized for seeming to suggest that public school teachers take a neutral position on Nazism, Baldwin apologized. And while he has walked back these comments, the state senator remains firmly supportive of Senate Bill 167, the Education Matters legislation he introduced this session. Now, if you just read the text of the bill, it seems, well, frankly, pretty innocuous. It says things like, a governing body of a school corporation shall create curricular materials advisory committee, or the governing body is directed to have teachers, administrators, representatives of the community, and parents of students who attend the school. It also tasks this governing body with, quote, reviewing all curricular materials and educational activities and making recommendations and presenting them at a public hearing. And also the bill says that teachers need to post their curricular materials online and allow parents to remove their children from educational experiences they find objectionable. So without context, I mean, the bill seems to just require schools to have a functioning PTA, an informative website, and some measure of parental choice. But it really says more than that. And that's precisely why context matters. As high school social studies teacher Matt Bockenfield emphasized during this same January 5th State Senate hearing, as he explained how he approaches difficult topics in his classes.
We're not neutral on Nazism. We take a stand in the classroom against it, and it matters that we do.
So to understand Senate Bill 167 and its aims, it must be read in the context of a pitched national battle over race and school curriculum. This bill does more than establish basic tools for parental input. Its design will have a chilling effect on how teachers like Matt are able to teach. This week, Matt Bockenfield spoke with The Takeaway.
We have to speak truth. We can't hide around it. You know, in a democracy, truth is oxygen. It's how democracies survive. And our classrooms really are the soul of that democracy. And so we have to find a way to use our classroom spaces to tell the truth about who we are as a nation, who we are as individuals, and what we could be.
Matt told us he never shies away from complicated topics as an educator.
We need classrooms where we collaborate together and we learn from and listen to one another and grow that way. And I really think, you know, a culture in a classroom like that lends itself to really difficult conversations. We have to have conversations about injustice, because when we don't challenge injustice, students become numb to it. And if we adjust ourselves to the injustices around us, those injustices perpetuate. And so we have to find a way to challenge those things in our classroom.
And Matt says that despite the ways legislators have tried to limit what teachers can say to their students, he's only more determined to do his job.
There's this quote by James Baldwin. He says, "There's nothing under heaven, no creed and no flag and no cause more important than a single human life." And for me, our classrooms, we have the opportunity in the face of a culture that can be dehumanizing every day. We have a chance to sort of breathe life and humanity into the American promise. And so for me, teaching is you know, the greatest privilege imaginable. And the challenges we're facing today, for me, they only rededicate me to the classroom. And so I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to keep, you know, staying in the trenches and serving our students and having these conversations.
For more, I'm joined now by Pedro Noguera, Dean of the School of Education, the University of Southern California. Great to have you here, Dean Noguera.
Hi, Melissa. It's great to be with you.
I have to say, I love a good social studies teacher, and that sense of commitment to the classroom. But help us understand what it is that teachers are facing in the face of these so-called Education Matters bills.
Yeah, I'm also encouraged by that teacher, but I think he's right. There's an attempt, and we're seeing it not just in Indiana, we're seeing it in Texas, we're seeing it in Oklahoma and several other states now, to ban certain books, to make it difficult to teach the history of racism and slavery in this country. It's really the kind of thing that you associate with authoritarian governments, where you ban books and try to control what people think. And what's remarkable is how quickly it swept the country after last fall's elections. My hope is that we'll see not only more teachers, but parents and students demanding for the right to an education that is not controlled by a Republican legislature.
So let's just dig in for a quick second, just on the technical aspect in one sense. And that is, this bill says you got to put up all your curriculum online, basically so that teachers will tell everything that's going to happen. And then parents can decide if they want to opt in or opt out, just from a pure practicality, given the realities of public school. What does that even look like? What would that mean for teachers?
You know, talk about the stress teachers are under, to talk about adding all these materials online so that it can be approved or not by parents. This is, you know, adding to the burden on teachers as it is. But what's more, it's really designed to encourage this kind of political scrutiny. And what we want is for kids to learn to think critically about the world they're in, about the past, so they're prepared for the future. This is going in the opposite direction.
I want to read to you a quick piece from the bill here. This is language directly from the bill. And it says that any individual, right, so it's saying that this is what can't happen, that any individual should feel discomfort guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of the individual's sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, national origin, or political affiliation. Dean, I feel like I've just had 5 years of conversations with folks who were from the ideological right saying that safe spaces are a problem, that we should not be creating safe spaces, particularly in higher ed and in K through 12. But this sounds like safe spaces legislated.
I was thinking the same thing, Melissa. And I was also thinking about a visit I paid to Muncie, Indiana a few years ago. And I visited a church when I was speaking at Ball State University, a church with a black church that took in the bodies of Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith. And you may recall there was an iconic image of a lynching that took place there in Marion, Indiana, and the bodies were brought to Muncie and defended because the mob wanted to tear the bodies apart. The children of Indiana have a right to learn that history. They need to learn that history. In fact, some of the perpetrators of the crime might even still be alive. We have a bloody history, not only in Indiana, but in the country. And the only way we can ensure that future generations will not perpetuate the crimes of the past is if we understand them. Any attempt to silence the past is an attempt to deny kids a good education. And I should add here, Melissa, that these new laws are at odds with the state's standards. And so the state is, in fact, opening itself up to lawsuits because there's not a single state in the country that has adopted standards that say you cannot teach America's history.
I'm always very worried, particularly in the context of like doing media, that we're just chasing red herrings, that this isn't a real thing, right? That that there's no one teaching in the schools, or so very few, like vanishingly few teachers who are like standing in the schools in Indiana or Missouri or North Carolina and teaching, for example, what's, you know, banned in this bill, which is you can't teach that hard work, is racist, basically. And I'm like, who's teaching that? If it is a red herring, if this is a distraction, what is it attempting to distract us from? I'm worried there might be actually something else going on in education we should be paying more attention to.
Well, I think that Steve Bannon and others decided that this was a political strategy that could mobilize the base. And it appeared to work to some degree in the Virginia elections last fall. And I think they're hoping this will help them in the midterms. But it's a really a very cynical strategy to try to use fears about race to mobilize voters. Again, I hope that they'll produce a backlash from others who think kids deserve the right to learn and should not be prevented from reading and controversial topics that are important.
Now, as a dean of the School of Education, you are in part educating educators. You're educating those who will be, who will be leading our school systems into the future and writing curriculum and all of those kinds of things. And the one thing I agree with, like if this, again, was out of context, is we shouldn't just tell young people what to think. In fact, if you do, they'll probably just think the opposite. But we should be developing critical reasoning skills. Maybe just sort of curricular or approach suggestions for folks about how to think about when you come to difficult topics, how do we teach them in a way that promotes that critical self-reasoning and reflection?
You know, I think that it is important that when you touch on different topics, controversial topics like slavery, that you write about it or you expose kids to multiple perspectives that so they understand point of view. They understand how could someone like Thomas Jefferson write such liberatory language in the Declaration of Independence and be an owner of slaves? Come to terms with those contradictions so we can understand how the founding fathers could in fact been slave owners is an important part of understanding America's history. So, you know, we grapple with difficult subjects and then we try to make sense of them. And I think that's what a good education does for a person. It doesn't teach you what to think, but hopefully helps you to think and process information so you're better able to handle the controversies of the moment we're in.
Okay, Dean, you're not a you know, primary, you know, lower school teacher, but I'm still, you know, everybody in the professional field of education, I have been kind of asking this of in the past year as we were, you know, sort of going through this particular moment. And it's just this: is there a value to teaching the sort of aspirational American story in our early sort of K through five education before complicating it, right? So in other words, I wonder about those January 6th rioters and, you know, if they had the, you know, I can't help myself. I just really am like an unreconstructed patriot in the sense of like, I get emotional, you know, in Washington, D.C., I'm emotional about the state houses. Is there something valuable about teaching the not so accurate history, but just that ties us to a sense of self, a sense of patriotism and community, and then, you know, kind of coming in and challenging that? Or should we be teaching the whole truth and nothing but the truth from the beginning?
Well, I think we have to be careful with what children can handle in terms of exposure to violence and violent themes at a young age. And so I would certainly be careful about exposure. But I don't think the goal of teaching history is to teach patriotism. The goal of teaching history is to help kids to understand, you know, the past and how it's led up to the present. And, you know, Americans as a rule have trouble with understanding history. And I think it's in part because we don't do a very good job of bringing it to life. When I taught history myself in Providence schools, I made sure that we dealt with topics that have meaning today to young people. And I think that's what makes it matter, what makes civics matter. And so I think even if the goal isn't to encourage loyalty, it should be to encourage an appreciation for how our history has shaped the society that we live in.
I also wonder about this notion that teachers should not share their own perspectives. I got to say, I think there's something valuable about students knowing at all ages that their teachers are whole people, that they have perspectives. And if it can be done with humility, that my perspective doesn't mean it's all right, isn't that part of the value of the back and forth, the engagement with our students?
I think so. And I do think there's a fine line. Teachers should not use the classroom as a place to espouse their views and impose them on their students. At the same time, they can explain why they think the way they do, but encourage their students to make up their own minds and to give them plenty of opportunities to write, to think, to debate, so that they learn the value of civil discourse, something that this country desperately needs right now.
Pedro Noguera, Dean of the School of Education at the University of Southern California. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Melissa. It's great being with you.
That's the show, folks. Thanks as always for checking us out. Call us with show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back tomorrow. I'll be here.